doesn't get in time to make the meeting. She sent her regrets. Bill is here. Yeah, we have a quorum. Brian, I'm not sure. Unless he had some last minute thing that I didn't know of.
You were hoping to have pictures.
Yeah, but look his way.
Well, just be a
we won't have Betsy though.
I'm going to give Bill about 30 seconds, and then it's going to be gavel time.
Sure.
Into a little boys' room?
Yeah, I saw him sneak in there. We'll just note his late entry. Are you about ready to rock and roll? Okay. Call this meeting of the Houghton Community Council to order. Could we have roll call, please?
Neil Black.
Here.
Kelly Curtis.
Here.
Brian Gothrop. Bill Goggins. John Kapler.
Here.
Betsy Pringle. Rick Whitney.
Here. So for tonight, we have council member reports, followed by requests from the audience, and then we're going to take up temporary signs and the permanent offsite sign regulations. At the last meeting, I mentioned the reconsideration after thinking it through, and so this is where staff has come back with some additional information for us to reconsider our recommendation. And then we also will be reviewing the neighborhood plan framework. So, and let the minutes show that the record show that Brian Gothrop has just arrived. So, and we don't have any minutes to approve. So let's go to council member reports and comments. And I'm going to lead off by acknowledging some special guests in the audience. We have the East Bellevue Community Community Council Chair Betsy Hummer and Vice Chair Stephanie Walter here to see how we conduct business. So welcome, you guys. It's great to have you here. Maybe we can get together for some excuse for getting the two councils together sometime. That would be great. And let the record show that we have Bill Goggins in the audience or in attendance. So council member reports. Anybody? Kelly, I'll bet you've got
always
something for us. Yeah, come on.
Okay, housing strategy draft plan will be presented to City Council on March 6th. I will not be there that night because I'm running a workshop in Seattle. I will forward to everyone on the council to get their feedback as soon as it's in form for council. I do not believe that there's anything in it that these council members will have any objection to. It's discussion of ADU zoning, infill, development by transit, that sort of thing. But in working on it, I get a fair amount of teasing from my fellow committee members on Houghton Community Council and how reluctant we are to have any affordable housing or that sort of thing. And I feel that we have a bit of a perception problem on Houghton Community Council, and I just want to put that out there for everybody to just kind of think about. One of the things that have been on my mind is the current press release about the City Council and the land swap with Arch, keeping the land in the Houghton neighborhood as affordable housing. And if you guys remember, we were the ones that insisted on that.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't been for us, they would have switched to residential.
Yeah.
Or what is it, micro housing.
Not only that, but down by the bus.
South Kirkland Park and Ride.
Yeah, South Kirkland Park and
Ride.
Right. Yeah.
So we're not as obstructionist as we're perceived, and I would like us to all think about how we can change that.
Okay.
Well, you can't believe everything you read on the internet, can you?
Anyone else have any?
Well. Yeah. Are you suggesting that we maybe write a press release or something about
maybe
this?
Maybe once or twice, yeah.
So I think that has some traction that maybe we ought to talk about. Yeah, because it's the same thing with the other thing we mentioned several months ago about the rezone.
Yeah.
Because I do think we're doing good things that our constituents want. And
there's reasons that we're doing it,
and
we're just not getting
that.
The word
exactly.
out.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I'd be happy to assist with that. So,
okay.
Is that?
I think that's a great idea.
Do we want
somebody else is willing to do it? I love it. So, John and Kelly, you guys want to take that on and
sure
prepare something for, do you want to, the idea being maybe prepare it, present it to our next meeting for, and then get it out, or
we'll kick around some ideas and yeah, see what we have to talk about now, and if it's not now, maybe down the road.
Okay.
Yeah, I could add it to an agenda, maybe the next agenda, and we could discuss it as a formal agenda item if that works.
Okay.
Sure.
I like that, Adam. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else? Neil, John? Nope. Okay. Then do you want to discuss work program review at this time, or is there anything worth considering, Adam?
Yeah, just wanted to note that the City Council did adopt the planning work program at the last meeting. There was a relatively minor amendment, which was getting staff to look at parking requirements for retail and restaurant uses downtown. So that's another discrete task added to the work program, which is already fairly yeah, ambitious, but we'll fit another project on. So there's concern that restaurants are not locating in downtown in certain new projects because of the relatively higher parking requirements for restaurants compared yeah, to retail uses. So the City Council simply wanted us to look at existing parking requirements, what other cities are doing, and propose some recommendations for either keeping our parking regulations, our parking ratios the same for restaurants downtown, or changing them a bit. So we'll report back probably in a couple months.
That's not a small project.
We'll try to make the scope as narrow as possible.
Okay.
Rick, I have a question cool on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Adam, on the work program, I see that North and South Rose Hill will go together.
That's right, with Bridal Trails and 85th Street Corridor.
Okay, and so we have some jurisdiction over
Bridal Trails,
a corner of that, yeah, so we'll be reviewing that again.
That's right, yeah, you'll be looking at the plan.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We now have an opportunity for any of our audience members to talk to us about whatever you feel like you'd like to share with us. Anybody care to speak? Come on up. Give us your name and address.
Can you hear me?
Yes, yep, we can.
Okay. My name is Don McHale. I live at 4604 Lake Washington Boulevard, Northeast. Thank you.
Could you speak into the mic? Is that mic on?
Is there a green light on the base?
Is the mic on?
Well,
You were soft, and I want to make sure that we're able to not only hear you, but you're being recorded. So.
Not very important. I just wanted to know that I'm looking into how the community is organized. I'm
lived here in Kirkland.
There we go.
I've lived here in Kirkland for 30-some-odd years, and I've been through a couple of programs, but I still don't understand how everything interfaces. You know, we're talking about, I'm looking at, just from where I'm standing, it looks like I live in Lakeview, so there's a Lakeview committee, there's a Lakeview owner, whatever. Anyway, you've got all these different
levels
political
of, yeah,
or interest groups, and I'm trying to figure out which ones they are and what they are, where they are, and what they do. So if I want to get something done, because I went through a lot of work with the council many, many years ago, and it didn't come out quite the way I thought it should come out. So I'm going to go back and look at going back into that.
Was that on the neighborhood plan update, or was it on something specific to your property?
I have
property?
Absolutely no idea.
It was the Lakeview neighborhood plan update.
It was
update.
Lakeview yeah, neighborhood plan update. Uh-huh. I guess that's
okay.
What it is. Okay.
Okay.
John's one of my favorite helpers here, so.
And ours too.
So I'm just trying to figure out how I can look into what some of my concerns are, and who I would, you know, work with, and so on and so forth. So.
Okay.
And that's what. And this is my first trip out in to see what's out here again after several years. So.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in getting to know you and getting to know how this group fits with that group, fits with that group, and so on and so forth. So,
well, if it's something specific to your property, you're going to want to start with city staff.
Yeah.
And then to the extent that city staff's not being responsive, or you know, you've got questions that they're not helping you with, and
I'm not anywhere close to that.
Okay.
Just as a general overview, it's just that we did all this work, and I thought the idea was to advance the neighborhood, and I don't feel it did that. So I want to get it restarted. So,
Dawn, I believe on the city website, John, there is information about all the neighborhood associations.
Okay.
So Lakeview, Central Houghton, and Everest.
Okay.
Are the ones you want to look at, the ones we chatted about.
Okay.
All the contact information for your Houghton Community Council members are on the website as well. And if you have any questions about how to get to that, probably the main number to City Hall, John, is if you called to just the main number to City Hall and said, I want to get to someplace on the website that could help you find the right place.
Yeah.
And then the chairs for the neighborhood associations are really the ones you want to chat with. I think for what you're after, they're the best ones.
And those are on the website too. I saw Larry Totally was on there. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Brian's kind of the techie in here.
You can just do a Google search for Houghton Community Council, and it will bring up.
I've worked through all those. They haven't changed that much in the last whatever it's been since I got involved in this in 4 or 5 years. So.
Okay.
I'm just starting to start over again here. Okay. And see
glad
if I
you're
can
involved.
Make things work more like I think they should work, and I think what I want is better for the whole community, as well as the city.
That's great.
Because it's a beautiful city.
Yeah.
And I was going to sell out and move, but sorry, there's no place else to go.
Well, we're glad you're staying.
Okay. So thank you very much.
Before you step away, Don, since we didn't, the mic wasn't on,
sure.
Could you once again name
an
address?
Again, I'm Don McHale. I live at 4604 Lake Washington Boulevard, Northeast.
Great. Thank you, Don.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Don.
Okay. So now let's talk about the temporary signs regs. Welcome, John.
Thank you. John Regala, planning supervisor with the City of Kirkland and project planner with this project. File number is CAM17-00419, and tonight is the reconsideration meeting on this project as requested by the Houghton Community Council. The public hearing was held on January 11th, and at that meeting we discussed the changes, proposed changes for temporary and off-site directional signs. The majority of that hearing was focused mainly on the temporary A-frames, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. So at that hearing, following the hearing, the Planning Commission and Houghton Community Council recommended the standards that you see on the screen in terms of location of these signs being allowed on private property as well as in the right-of-way, as long as there's a minimum 5-foot clearance on the sidewalk, a limit of one per business, a maximum size of 6 square feet, and to be only displayed during business hours. So following the hearing and meeting, the Houghton Community Council expressed desire to potentially reconsider their recommendation, specifically in regards to clutter, the potential impacts the implementation of these regulations could create, as well as the consequences. We were asked staff to look at the City of Mill Creek and their example of post-style temporary signs, potential problem areas in the city, as well as the potential to defer this project to the larger project of amending the sign code for later this year. So the Houghton Community Council should deliberate after my presentation and then provide a final recommendation. I do want to note that three public comment emails or letters were received after the hearing. I prepared a packet in front of you in case you haven't read it, but there was one letter from the chamber which expressed support of the recommendations from both groups on the proposed changes, and there were two citizen comment emails regarding, in general, the need to establish the regulations now so that the city has the authority in terms of code enforcement to actively enforce on these temporary signs. There was some support for a limited display of these A-frames with very strict guidelines, as well as concern about the locational standards for these types of signs. So on the in terms of research, staff looked at the post-style signs that the city of Mill Creek adopted. It originated in 2008 when they had like a temporary program to see how these types of signs would work, because they ban A-frames outright. Due to the success of that program in 2008, they actually implemented as regulations in 2011. Generally speaking, these signs have a very, there's very prescriptive standards. They're 2x2, so 4 square feet, 4 feet tall, have to be made out of iron. They have wheels so that you can wheel them out during business hours and then wheel them back in when the business is closed. A sign permit is required for this type of sign, and in order for it to be allowed in the right-of-way, you'd need some sort of variance approval from the director. Staff, in terms of implementing it here in Kirkland, we do have some concerns. It's a very, one-piece or one design standard for all signs, so there's concern there. Potential cost implication to owners. I don't have an exact cost number, but relatively speaking, you can buy, a fairly cheap A-frame sign for up to $100. And later on, we'll discuss these multi-panel A-frames, that approach. I did contact Tubart, a sign company, to see how much that would cost. So they can make that type of sign, and they said maybe $200, $300, kind of in that ballpark. So I would presume that this type of sign, where it's made of metal, custom, maybe similar cost, maybe a little bit more expensive. I'm not sure. I didn't have that information. At the hearing,
can I ask you a quick question about
sure.
that? Do you have any idea if the city up there maybe gets them in bulk and then sells them to the merchants? Since it's the same design for all of them.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can follow up and figure that out. But
just from a cost standpoint, yeah.
I mean, I could tell, for the city of Kirkland, I know at least with our public notice signs that you see out there, we do have a standard for that. And what we typically would do is just give that standard to the applicant, who then would go to a sign company, right, give them the standard, and they would construct it, and the applicant would pay for that. So
okay,
maybe it's a similar approach. So at the public hearing, I discussed two scenarios that we see typically happening with businesses in these types of signs. The first was where the business was along a sidewalk. And as you see there on this screen, you have the A-frames either in the right-of-way or immediately adjacent to the building. So if the codes were adopted as recommended, I think a lot of the signs here that you would see, the A-frames, assuming they were providing 5 foot of clearance on the sidewalk and not in a sight distance triangle, they would be allowed, except for the flag signs that you see.
Wait, could you go back on that, John? I thought mm-hmm. that the recommendation staff made for signs, they had to be adjacent to the structure. Did you yeah. say that they could be out on the edge of the sidewalk?
Correct.
Oh, okay, I misunderstood that.
As recommended, currently.
Oh, I understand, staff's recommendation in here, I thought it was...
Oh, sorry. That was the previous recommendation.
Previous. But what you're recommending here is different then.
Correct.
Got it. Okay, yes. Thank you.
Yeah. And the second scenario is where you have a business set back some distance from the street or sidewalk, and what you see is the signs being placed out by the curb to gain exposure. So again, with the previous recommendation, this would be allowed.
Yeah.
I did a little bit of research in looking at potential problem areas, especially in Houghton. So the two examples I provided in your packet are, in regards to Houghton Plaza and Houghton Center. So on the top example, you're traveling south on 6th Street. You have the Menchie's to the right. Mm-hmm. So there's about, I think it was 10 or 11 businesses. So you could see that if each business were allowed a sign out by the right-of-way, there is the potential there for quite a bit of clutter, you could say. In the example below, it's the Houghton Center, where you have the Metropolitan Market. Again, quite a bit of signs could potentially be out along the street and the sidewalk. Some solutions to this would be to prohibit these types of signs outright along the street front, or to limit the number, as you'll see in our recommendations later. But as far as successful A-frame examples, Adam and I actually took a walk downtown to see, you know, are there possibilities or regulations that we can create that get at, you know, A-frame signs that do work. And what we found that the successful A-frames were fairly modest in size, so 6 square feet or less in size. They were of a high-quality design that was reflective of the business. They were typically next to the building entrance at the building, and there was enough room on the sidewalk for pedestrians to move. One thing I did want to note was that the blade signs were fairly successful too. So instead of having the signs at the ground level, they're actually up above, either projecting from the building or under an awning. So we thought those were very successful in terms of gaining exposure.
Before you leave the blade signs, could you give us an overview on what are the limitations on blade signs and what the permit process is for those?
Currently, we allow blade signs for commercial businesses, so downtown it would be allowed. The maximum size, I believe, is 4 square feet, and you can have one per entrance or vehicular entry.
Okay.
And sign permit would be required. Correct.
Mm-hmm. Is the blade sign what, like, Supercuts uses? Is that what we're talking about?
It's the Toby's Estate, or it's the up above.
It's the hanging thing.
Yeah, it's up above.
It's suspended up above the right away.
I'm sorry. It has a...
Or it's sometimes attached to the side of the building also.
Right. Yeah.
Yep. Correct. The not-so-successful A-frame examples would be, you know, you should start seeing these signs away from the building, out by the curb. Some of them were larger, so they end up being in the pedestrian realm, right? Providing clutter. They seem like they're just out there in their own islands, right? So in terms of the staff recommendation, we kind of took all those, you know, what worked, what didn't, and we've proposed the following on your screen. So the first several rows deal with the location of these signs. So we're recommending that they be allowed both on private property and the right-of-way. In both situations, they need to be next to the building wall at the building entrance. And if it happens to be there's a sidewalk there, that you need to have at least 5 feet of clearance for pedestrians.
One clarification on that.
Yes.
If in the proximity of where the sign's being located, there's like a utility pole or a tree or a planter or, you know, something else that's in there that also causes a constriction on the use of the sidewalk. Are you taking it 5 feet to the edge of the sidewalk or 5 feet to the obstruction?
It would
be
clear. Yeah, you just need to have five feet. So if there's a landscape.
So if there's anything else, then that doesn't qualify. That's not clearance then.
Correct.
Got it. Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure.
So as far as being located on the right-of-way, we did add an additional restriction, and it would be to limit a property to only one sign when it's not located next to the building entrance for a multi-panel tenant sign. And that's to address the issue that you see there on the top right picture, the two pictures to the right, where we want to avoid the clutter issue at the street frontage when they're away from the building. So that's where I kind of mentioned previously that, you know, we contacted a sign company. Hey, is it even possible to have an A-frame sign with multiple panels? And they said, yeah, it's possible. It's just, it'll take some coordination on the part of maybe the property manager, but we feel that the trade-off balance is struck there between clutter and allowing a sign out along the frontage. So we'd limit the number of signs to one per business. The size is 6 square feet. Originally, we did contemplate having a slightly larger sign at 8 square feet for the signs out at the street, but we just felt that, or at least staff recommendation is that we just don't want to see larger signs out there. The The duration remains the same, during business hours only. And then to deal with the aesthetic issue, we did add some language about prohibiting certain types of A-frames. And you'll see we're looking at or recommending prohibiting the changeable letter signs. Mm-hmm. That you see here, the first sign on the left. And then to prohibit the erasable sign face if it has a white writing surface. What we found is that it looks not exactly the best, but we found like with the darker, the black or the dark gray charcoal with the chalk and everything, it looks really nice. So we would support that type of A-frame.
John, before we move on, under location right of way, I'm a little confused on this. So many of the B2 office complexes will have 4 or 5 tax parcel numbers, a tax parcel number for each building that makes up one complex that might be construed as a property. So in the right-hand side of the picture, the lower photograph, I'm going to bet there's several tax parcels with those buildings. So I think the term property would really default back to tax parcel numbers. So there might be 4 or 5 tax parcel numbers in there.
Correct.
Meaning 4 or 5 different properties. The second question that I have is I'm a little confused on the sentence limited to one sign per property when not located at a building entrance for multi-tenant panel sign. That seems to, I think we're missing an antecedent or something in there, because multi-tenant panel sign, if each person gets, I think a bit more might need to be in there. It's just a bit confusing to me. Okay, so in the lower photograph on the right side, those 2, 4, 6, does all that information need to be on one A-frame sign that's a maximum of 6 square feet? Or if there's 6 parcel numbers in there, is it 6 parcels? And if there's 3 tenants per each building, I'm not sure how that works. So that might need a little clarification. Because I'm afraid somebody is going to be very clever with the rule and go, oh, well, this is exactly what it says, and it's not what we intend. Am I the only one that's confused on this sentence?
No, I was going to ask for clarification on that. And there's no, you had talked about if it's a multi-tenant sign having allowing 8 square feet, is that your intent or it's not specified? So
we're contemplating that, but decided against it.
So
just keep it standard. One sign at 6 square feet. And it will consist of multiple tenant panels.
And the number of, sorry, if I could just clarify really fast, the number of tenant panels on that multi-tenant sign is up to the property owner.
Right.
Right? So, I mean, there could be 6 businesses on that property, but the property owner might decide just to have 2 panels on that one sign for 2 businesses, or 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. Or you get Wednesday and you get Thursday and you get Friday or whatever. Right?
There are probably lots of creative iterations. Yeah.
But the intent is?
One sign.
One sign.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. I might suggest
you may not just read it so well on this chart, but if you were to look at the actual language in the packet, I think it gets, hopefully it's clear. If not, we'll
Where is clarify. That, John, in the ordinance?
It's actually on page 7 of the staff memo. It's where it's
3B.
Oh, I mean, okay. But so not in attachment 1.
No, that was from the previous
That's the
hearing.
Previous. Okay, that Correct. Explains some of the confusion I was having when I was looking at attachment 1.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. I have one quick question, Rick, if I can ask
you. Sure,
please. So let's say there's, so I'm particularly concerned about the small business owner who can't afford the frontage unit property lease and is in the back and does want to have that sign out there. If there happens to be only one of them, they could have that panel sign. They could have that sign out in the right of way with only one business owner on it. We're not mandating that it be multiple. It may... That they can allow, we're allowing for multiple tenants, but if there's only one tenant who's in that need, that sign could just have one business listed, correct?
Just one sign per property is allowed, right. And it's up to the property owner to determine who's on that sign.
Right. So that makes sense to me intellectually, but when I read the staff recommendation, limited to one sign per property when not located at the building entrance for a multiple tenant panel sign, it makes it sound like a multiple tenant panel sign is required.
Only, right.
And what we're really saying is one or more businesses.
Yeah, I think the correct. Issue think is, right. is really good. And at the end of the first sentence, it says multi-tenant panel sign. I think that's the...
Right.
Oops, sorry about that.
Yeah, we can clarify that. I think you're right, because in terms of content, we really shouldn't be that prescriptive as far as what's the content of the sign. But if our concern is really just one sign, and you only can have one per business, then I think that should satisfy.
Well, one for property.
Per property, right. sorry, yeah. per property. Right. Yeah. But there's also another layer of per business, because what we're trying to do is, if you're a business owner, you can only pick. It's either out at the street or by my frontage.
Right.
So we don't want two per.
Yeah. Right. I totally understand. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's that one business that is in the back that needs the sign out on the right of way that I would. I think we've heard from people that we want to allow that one, even if it's just, if there's two of them, then they meet the language as written. But if there's only one of them,
correct.
Arguably, they're not putting a multi-tenant panel sign out there. So,
yeah, we can make that change.
You just need to delete for a multi-tenant panel sign. Just put one A-frame sign is allowed per property, and then it's up to the property to determine
right.
what's on the sign.
So this would mean if you had a building that had 10 tenants, 9 of them could have them at their door on the sidewalk, and one of them could be out in the street.
No, in lieu of.
No, that's correct.
In lieu of.
In you lieu get of. One or the at, other. In lieu of a ba- at a building entrance, which refers back to A, that says.
Well, in lieu of means you don't get both.
Instead of.
But if you look at it in terms of a business, each business can pick. So you can either have an A-frame sign at your entry. So I think John's example is correct. So if 9 decide, oh, I want them all at my entry, that's fine. The 1 decides, oh, I don't want it at my entry. I want it out by the street. So that would be okay. So let's say a business decides, oh, I don't want it at my entry anymore, and wants it out at the street, they would have to create a multi-panel sign out by the street. So now you have 2 out by the street, 8 at their entrances.
Okay, so now I understand where you're going, but if you're saying that if some business in downtown, some property in downtown Kirkland has got 8 businesses all coming through the same entrance, and you're telling me that they can put 8 A-frame signs right at that entrance,
no, just one.
They are doing that now, but we
I
don't
understand
want
that.
Okay. No, and I think the term entrance here is the building door on the sidewalk, not the parking lot entrance.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to throw something out here before we get too far along. Okay, so if you look in the top picture, you will see that in the background there's a larger sign that's listing the tenants. What is that called?
A monument sign.
Monument sign. Okay, so if a development has a monument sign, which already lists who the tenants are, why would we allow them to add more signs to that property? So do we want to diverge that way? And then down the road, do we want in the code when people are building new properties, do we want them to require them to have a monument sign so that we can alleviate the need for A-frames altogether?
Yeah, to me that sounds like more of, that would be something I think we'd want to defer as part of the Chapter 100 sign code amendment. Because now you're starting to talk about permanent signs versus...
Right, but I do want to just put that out there for discussion later to require a monument sign. But I do question why, if we have a monument sign, we're also allowing A-frames. Because it's more noise.
With little teeny buttons.
Yeah.
I actually made a note on my that really what you're trying to achieve is what should be accomplished by the monument sign.
Yes. And I think that's the responsibility of the property manager.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We shouldn't be facilitating an A-frame sign serving the role or providing the function of a monument sign. Just because the property owner is too cheap to put up a monument sign.
Right. So if we go that route, though, what we're going to have to do is make there's going to have to be a requirement on the property owner to make sure there's space on their monument for every tenant, including if they divide up a space and add another tenant.
Yep.
Because what will happen is the tenants who are willing to pay the most rent are going to get the signage rights in the lease. And the tenant that, I don't know, that I think some of us are concerned about, the older entrepreneurs or the younger, just starting out entrepreneurs, they're not going to be able to afford the lease that includes the signage. So they're still going to be stuck in the back, and they're still not going to have a sign out on the monument. Okay. Unless we require the property owner when they, subdivide, or not subdivide, but would divide up a, space within their property, that they have to add, they have to make sure, the requirement would have to be, you have to supply a place on your monument sign for every lease, for every tenant you have in your building.
Do you really want to do that?
Well, don't we want to do that?
No. No, it's free enterprise. I mean, that's between the tenants and the landlord to come up with the best solution for everybody involved, and government shouldn't be determining that. Yeah.
And before we get into a deep philosophical discussion about
that's
science,
what we do,
which is great.
I knew I was going to sideline us, but
I just want to point out two things really quickly, not to make the conversation diverge, but one point is that pretty much any multi-tenant property that has the opportunity to have a monument sign has a monument sign. I mean, it's sort of a no-brainer for them. They'll want to have a monument sign to better advertise their businesses. Businesses want as many signs as they can get usually.
Yeah.
So that's sort of one point. And then the second point is that A-frames are almost always on top of an existing sign that's either a monument sign or attached to the building already. So I just want to make clear the fact that A-frames, just by their very nature, are redundant. Even if there's no monument sign, if a business wants an A-frame, they already have a sign attached to their building in all cases. So I just want to make clear that.
Kind of like the Ford dealership on 124th.
That's an extreme example. So.
Just saying.
So anyway, which sorry to interrupt.
Okay, thank you. More questions? Okay, John, we kind of got off track. Yeah, your turn.
I just have a comment. So to address, John, your question about property and different parcels and multiple tenants. One suggestion could be to change the term instead of property to subject property, because per our code, the subject property can consist of multiple lots, parcels that make up the development. Mm-hmm. So I think that would address your concern.
Well, I think that's the intent of what everybody mm-hmm. had talked about.
Yeah. So we can do that. And then, I think this is my last slide here. So the project to update the Chapter 100, our sign code, is planned for later this year. As I mentioned previously, it'd be great to have something adopted soon, to have clear understanding both for businesses as far as what they're allowed, and then for the city as far as what we need to enforce. The last bullet are some ideas that we have for improving our sign code, which gets to Ms. Curtis' comment. Should we allow more than one ground-mounted sign? Do we need to look at sign area allowances? Are they adequate currently as they are? Is there things to do that we can update our regulations as far as blade and projecting signs? Maybe make it less restrictive. Terms of maybe we don't need a permit for that type of sign, those kinds of things to encourage businesses to take that approach. And so my last question there is just, are there other items the Houghton Community Council would like staff to explore as part of that project?
Okay. Thoughts? Comments?
John? A couple of thoughts I had. So when is this supposed to be presented to City Council?
It's going to be the
March 20th.
Next meeting in the last meeting in March.
March 20th.
Okay.
March 20th is the date.
And so I think we need to make sure that we're really clear on what the differences we have compared to the Planning Commission. When we met with the Planning Commission, we went through, and so we should make sure that we kind of iron that list out tonight.
Well, what we recommend is definitely going to have differences from the recommendation that we had agreed to with the Planning Commission. And I'm going to, and I've already, you know, between talking with staff and city people, I think that everybody knows how this has gone. We're not trying to undermine the joint process. It was just after rethinking, we thought, you know, we can do better. And so have you guys communicated clearly to the Planning Commission where we're at on this, or do you want me to contact Planning Commission?
We've communicated that it's coming, that this issue is coming back to you for reconsideration.
Yep.
Obviously, the Planning Commission doesn't know where you ended up, but we'll communicate that to them at their next meeting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. If in any way you think it'd be helpful for me to talk directly with them, I'd be glad to do that.
Okay. Thanks.
Their feelings are hurt.
I don't think they are.
Okay, good.
They'll just roll their eyes at us.
Yeah, exactly.
There they go again.
Kind of like they were doing when we met jointly. Okay. Yes, John.
And so I looked at it, you know, it's the safety, it's the visual clutter, and it's the potential for a bad precedent and unintended consequence in the future, right? And so in kind of looking at some of these, I asked myself, well, is there a big difference between the A-frame sign and the Mill Creek sign? Yeah, probably not, in my mind. I mean, the Mill Creek sign looks a lot nicer, but is that really I don't think that's the issue in comparing to the three criteria that I mentioned. Another one, John, and you'd mentioned, you know, permitting these, and I'm like, a temporary sign. Is that really the issue in my mind? I don't think that's the issue either. The different types of signs, the changeable letter and the white background and the charcoal sign or a typical A-frame, maybe that's an issue because the more consistent, maybe the better. But I think that's the reason people put out A-signs anyway. It's because they're different. They draw attention. Oh, look, it's different than everything else out there. I mean, we're trying to come up with a new mousetrap. So I think, Kelly, you're really onto something about the monument sign. And I really think that the idea of that, if we could maybe look holistically at our sign code and, you know, maybe the monument signs need to be a little bit bigger. Maybe we need to focus on signage on the building, on sign bands, on box signs, on and on the blade signs, and that might be the issue. We're always going to have people put up rogue A-frame signs. Always going to have it happen. And so I'm probably, you know, people need to advertise for their business. They need to generate business. Boy, that is really, really, really important. But I just think these A-frame signs just scattered all around are probably not what we want in the city. And so I'm glad we're doing this and that we're reconsidering.
Okay.
I have a question. When you look at Houghton Center with this proposal from staff, if you go back to figure 7 with all the dots for potential signs, if there was one for each business, this one, top picture. So actually, it's bottom picture. So if you have one sign for multiple businesses, would there be just one sign for all of Houghton Center?
Or all the red dots move to the front doors of the businesses?
Right.
Or a combination. Well, currently, most of the businesses do have A-frames right outside their door. Out at Houghton Center, Bartels does, Met Market does, the Master Clips does, the Sub, mm-hmm. I think Subway does, the Pet Store does. All of them. I mean, but they're right outside their door. They're not out here on the sidewalk.
Right.
So that's a question.
Yeah, so there would just be one red dot.
There'd be one.
Yeah.
For the whole complex there.
Right. Where, so yeah, in this picture right here.
Yeah, so that would they would never choose that. Cause.
But as Kelly mentioned, I mean, if you look, there's a monument sign there already that already has.
Serving the purpose. Identifying the businesses that are located back in.
Mm-hmm.
The,
right. So to have only one, I don't think it really.
I really think that the best use of the A-frame is just right outside the door for any.
Right.
You know, It's like having the menu that you serve out there so people can see it, or
a sale.
Yeah, or sale, whatever, but just right outside the door. And that's it.
Yeah.
And that's what we heard from a couple of the constituents, one who spoke at our public hearing last month, and one who gave us comments just this week.
Right. I mean, to your point, though, Neil, you know, the businesses in the back that couldn't afford the front lease, you know, kind of like what Rick was saying, I mean, that's business. I mean, shouldn't have picked that property if what you needed was foot traffic.
Yeah. Well, I do like the staff's recommendation in that there is an option in this recommendation for one or two or three tenants who are behind and where there's no foot traffic, because they're just like, I'm thinking of in the, you know, in the PCC space, I think now it's a cat shelter,
mm-hmm.
but it hasn't always been a cat shelter, like a business way back there.
It's been for a while. Yeah.
They could, one or two businesses within that property could opt not to have an A-frame sign in front of their door, but go together on a multi-tenant panel out on the frontage to, I mean, I understand how, you know, free markets work, but I also think that we want to, you know, be business friendly too. I mean, that's one of the things we're hearing from the, you know, from some of the folks who provide us with comments too. And that seems like a nice compromise to me, that the staff has already built into their recommendation.
Yeah.
One of my main concerns is the clearance on the sidewalk, because I'm a runner. I run through downtown all the time on mm-hmm. Lake Street. That smoke shop used to have a big sign out in the middle of the sidewalk, and there was always people there, and it's hard to navigate around. A lot of times I just wanted to kick that thing into the street or kick it into the store. So what's the enforcement going to be like if we allow this?
So first of all, we enforce on a complaint basis. So if you do see something, you can complain to the city. We'll send one of our code enforcement officers out to pick up the sign, or at least notify the owner first, and then if they keep violating, we would pick up the sign. Secondly, we are planning on some weekend sign sweeps. So we'd have the two code enforcement officers for a couple hours on a Saturday, go throughout the city, see how many signs if they're in violation, then we'll pick them up. We've just been putting that on hold for a little bit.
Okay, I just hope that that's not just, you know, talk, that there's action behind that.
Yes.
They've done it in the past. When I had apartments down on just on State Street, my signs were confiscated on more than one occasion.
That was because it was you, Rick.
Yeah. So, yeah, they do that. Okay, any other questions, concerns, comments? John, I want to make sure I understand this clearly.
Okay.
And specifically, I'm thinking of the downtown place where I get my haircut. There's like 20 haircutters that all have like one entrance. Does this mean that...
What, define entrance real quick? Parking lot entrance or door
one entrance to the building off of the street. And there's like a 20 haircutters or nail, whatever, all the different things that they do in there. Every one of them would be entitled, under this, I understand, they would each be entitled to put a sign at the entrance? Every business?
As written, I think they would be allowed.
Okay. So
you're saying in one hair salon, there's 20 people in there cutting hair, and each one's their own business.
Everybody.
Every one of the 20 in this station 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way along, if they're all independent contractors and have their own little business, they'd all get an A-frame sign? Well, I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if I could clarify that situation, which is a good point, but... The clearance requirements also have to be met. So unless there's a really big sidewalk out front of that business, that would allow 20 signs to be placed without blocking 5 feet of the sidewalk, then it couldn't happen.
No, you could stack them all up along the entrance. Yeah, we haven't specified, you know, like if you're saying they have to be at the entrance, we haven't said they've got to be within 5 feet of the entrance.
And we didn't say they have to be on the ground. Somebody could hang it on a hook.
I'm just saying, and that does exist. And then I don't think it's the only example, but it's the one that I'm most familiar with. And I think that's why I was asking in my mind, it seems like you should either have the sign should be for at the entrance to the business, mm-hmm. or if you have a property that has multiple tenants that have access through the same entrance, then they get one. They get the choice of the one sign.
Yep.
With multiple tenants on it, or whatever they work out, or they may just choose, maybe there's only one tenant that really wants a sign, whatever. But to allow every business to have a sign, I think, is a problem.
Yeah. No,
unless they have a separate business entrance.
I think you're right. I think as written, it would allow the multiple signs, but I think we do need, if we really want to limit just, well, I think we should probably limit to one per entrance. We'd have to add that language.
I think if you just, like, and on 3A on page 7, instead of A-frame signs should be placed adjacent to the building wall at the building entrance, say the business entrance. And then, in lieu of an A-frame sign at the business entrance, or what a building entrance, whatever, one standalone A-frame sign allowed per property, you know, if you've got multiple tenants. I think that's, otherwise I see potential problems.
Or under 3A, how about if we just keep that first sentence as is, and then just add a limit, only one per entrance, building entrance.
Fine. That works.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can't say building entrance because in the case of many of your photographs, there's a single building that has multiple tenants, and each tenant has a tenant entrance. Because, you know, even by code, if you're so many square feet, you need more entrances, or actually exits. Mm. You need exits. And each one of those is a building entrance exit. So now we're in, you know, code definition that I know is not clarified in our definitions.
Not all of those entrances are accessible to the public. That's what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah, we can clarify that.
Yeah, I think we understand the intent. So we'll
draft language. That will meet that intent.
Yeah.
Everybody, now I don't want to be railroading this.
No.
Is that
a good point.
A point that you guys concur on? Mm-hmm. Is there anybody that disagrees with that? Okay, good. Thank you. Because otherwise I see real potential for unintended consequences.
That's a good one.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think the difficulty is that once you have these things, they're hard to take away.
Yeah.
That's the issue. I mean, once you grant these, we relook at the sign code, it's going to be hard to take them away.
Okay. Just also a clarification, John. If somebody wanted to put little, like, LED lights on one of these signs, battery operated, is that specifically prohibited anywhere?
Yes, I believe we put that in. Let me just double check, though. I think in attachment 1. So page 9 at the bottom. So under 1B, illumination must be non-illuminated.
Got it. Okay. Perfect.
What about moving signs?
Can't regulate.
You can't regulate that? So I could I could put a little doily thing on there that goes, and that's not regulable.
That regulatable. I thought you meant like the
the people that flip signs. A standard sign.
We do prohibit.
Yeah, standards.
The moving signs are prohibited.
Yeah.
In our standard code.
But for temporary signs, are they prohibited? Because they're prohibited, and reader boards and that sort of thing in permanent signs. What about temporary signs?
I would say so. I don't think it distinguishes temporary versus permanent on the prohibited sign list.
Really?
I can look it up.
Okay.
We can confirm that too when we go back.
One last thought, John. I know that it staff's not recommending the Mill Creek recommendation, and I think it'd be premature to do it. But I think it's worth at least making the city council aware that it's something you may want to consider when you reconsider all of the permanent or the major sign ordinance modifications. And I think the way to go about it would be to just poll the downtown community and just say, this is what we're going to do for temporary signs, and if you would like to see something different, this is what Mill Creek's got. If you think that would be a better way to sign for downtown. I really see that as a downtown alternative.
Yeah, that's,
not,
I wanted to clarify that too. This is a KDA thing, not everywhere.
Exactly, yeah. So I just think it's worth at least making that option known.
With those Mill Creek signs, I worry about maybe a trip hazard if the legs or the wheels are out further than the sign itself.
Well, I don't think they can be.
No. If you look at it, it's
The design, it has to be, that base has to be within the space of the sign.
Okay.
If it's out there on the sidewalk, somebody will trip over it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the enforcement thing again.
Yes.
So when you confiscate a sign, do they get it back or do you keep it?
They get it back, and then if they're in violation again, then we toss them.
Yeah.
Okay, and then can they go and buy another one and put it up after you do that?
I mean,
where
it could.
Is if you get a serial violator, can you like ban them from having an A sign again?
We could. I don't think we've ever done this, but if there's a frequent violator, we can take them to hearing. Yeah. Go to code enforcement hearing, and that could be one of the remedies that we could ask for.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those
but we've never done
cheap.
That.
When you get a couple of them confiscated, and you've already gotten your get out of jail free one kind.
This is hypothetical, right?
Yeah.
No, Rick apparently knows.
I'm just saying it's you learn your lesson after you've had a couple signs that's confiscated. Okay. So, any other?
So, can we go back to the staff recommendation page and make sure we're all on the same page?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so we had a discussion about the second under location about building entrances, business entrances. Okay, so I agree with everything on that, with that clarification.
Basically, we're going to make the recommendation what staff has recommended, subject to
clarifying that
one per entrance, regardless of how many businesses are entering through that spot, and so.
And John's comment about property, about tax property.
Yes.
That clarification also, right?
Yes.
So two
change
clarifications.
Change it to subject property, which is what it is in the code.
Yep.
Right.
And then, I'm sorry, I thought there was one other item as well, which is, Neil, your item about clarifying that only that one off,
yes.
out of entry sign can actually have just one tenant name on it. It doesn't have to have multiple tenants. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, I think it's an obvious point to all of us, but I think the language should be clear about that.
Yeah.
Great. So I appreciate that. So those three clarifications.
With those clarifications, could we have a motion to approve staff's recommendation subject to those modifications?
So moved.
All right. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? Discussion. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Excellent. Thank you, guys.
Thank you,
John.
Yes.
Great work. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I want to make, John, thanks for coming out another evening to discuss this with us, because I know that we probably could have handled this more efficiently at some point in the process, but it's really nice of you to come back out.
Great feedback, and I think it resulted in
We got a better result, so I'm glad.
Does that mean you're going to explain this with enthusiasm to the Planning Commission?
That we made it better?
Look at Adam's smile. What's going to happen is next time they have to come out here, they're going to have to draw straws as to who comes in front of us.
All right. So neighborhood plan framework.
All right.
Adam.
So not as glamorous as A-frame signs or other temporary signs, but... it's a very relevant topic. You have all just been through a neighborhood planning process that was contentious and sort of drawn out in schedule. So I'm actually really looking forward to getting your feedback on this framework. And sort of as a preliminary remark, I just want to say that the overall objective of creating this framework is really to address the sort of underlying tension in pretty much all of our planning projects, but especially our neighborhood planning projects, which is really how to make the process a little more streamlined while fostering good public input. So there's, you know, these two factions that need to be reconciled. There's the, you know, the single working mom who doesn't have 3 years to invest in getting involved in the planning process, and there's, you know, the person that really just loves the process, and it doesn't matter if it takes 2 or 3 or even longer, more years to do the plan. We have to sort of reconcile those two you know, parts of our demographic. And so what I'll do tonight is just give a very broad overview of the framework, because I want to save time for discussion and get your thoughts as well, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So there are really two aspects to the genesis of the framework. One is, you know, our experience with neighborhood plans to date. And there's a sense that people are relatively satisfied with the outcome, but that the process could be better. There are elements of the process that could be made better. And then two, in recognition of that idea, this implementation strategy on the slide, NP4 of the comp plan, calls for this comprehensive template for future neighborhood plans to help streamline the process while still providing for planning efforts that are really customized for the neighborhoods that are undergoing the neighborhood planning process. So this project, this framework project, was really about implementing that implementation strategy to make our planning process and outcome better, and then engaging with the public a little more productively. So we did quite a bit of public outreach before coming up with the framework. We reviewed feedback from previous neighborhood planning processes. We talked to people closely involved in recent processes. We discussed the project with decision makers. We reviewed old minutes from Cannes, where they tried to pick apart the neighborhood planning process. And we tried to really identify places in the process that could be made better. And so this slide here summarizes some key themes that emerge from that sort of that public input process. The first is education. The idea here is that not every plan participant is really starting on the same page for neighborhood planning with the same foundational knowledge, and there needs to be some degree of education about the process and planning in general, really, and the relationship of neighborhood plans to the comprehensive plan. But the education needs to be in digestible bits with opportunities for self-learning. People don't necessarily want to come to a, you know, 4-hour lecture on urban design at the beginning of the neighborhood planning process. Second bullet point, while some folks are okay with the long process, many people express concern that it's really tough for working people to sustain, you know, a process longer than a year. Expectations. We need to create expectations for both staff and community participants in the planning process, including how input will be used from the public, who has ultimate responsibility for plan adoption, is it city council, is it the neighborhood group, is it somebody else, and how long the process is going to take so that plan participants can really prepare for what will be a very intense planning process. And then don't reinvent the wheel. We heard a lot of suggestions about coming up with some standard format for plans, and having that as a starting point instead of, you know, approaching neighborhood groups with more of a blank canvas and saying, here's an empty page, let's fill it up with a plan. And then last but not least, the relationship to the comp plan. So that the theme here is that the updated neighborhood plan should be consistent with the broad, you know, citywide policies in the comp plan, but they shouldn't duplicate those policies. So those are really the themes that shape the framework. And now I'll just really quickly go through the sections of the framework. There are 6 sections of the framework that are included in the packet. The first is expectations for process. So as you can see here, this section was organized into a table. There are key expectations identified for staff and neighborhood members in a range of areas: baseline knowledge, education, schedule, the role of the working group, the number of administrative drafts for the plan, and then the plan scope. And so this just reinforces some of the overarching themes made evident in the public feedback, mainly that we need to do a better job helping residents understand, you know, how their plan fits into the confines of the comp plan, and just helps them understand how the process is being structured. So next is the scope of work. And this section was really created so that we're as transparent as possible about the process from start to finish, and that we have baseline expectations for when things like public meetings happen, how web surveys are used to collect information from the public, how many administrative drafts of the plan there should be, and when you, the Houghton Community Council, and the Planning Commission, and the City Council provide input on the plan so that people know what they're getting into from the very beginning. And this is not to say that the scope of work for the plan can't be modified, but it just provides a starting point for creating a plan so that we're just not recreating the plan from scratch every single time. And so that's really the scope of work. And then the next section is the schedule. And the overarching objective here is to undertake any plan update, complex or not so complex, in about a year. So it just involved converting the scope of work into a chronology and then making sure we had the right types of meetings at the right points in the process. Enough meetings, but not too many meetings. And again, you know, the idea here was to make this a real neighborhood-driven process, but we really want the Planning Commission, the Houghton Community Council, and the City Council to make their expectations for changes in the neighborhood early in the process so that the neighborhoods aren't surprised by what, you know, the decision makers want, and so the decision makers aren't surprised by what the neighborhood wants. That is schedule, plan outline. The question that we really asked ourselves here was, you know, how might the neighborhood plan itself be streamlined to make for better plans that are less duplicative of the comp plan? And so what we did here was we looked at some good recent examples of plans and we tried to really winnow them down to their very essence. So this template calls for every plan to have an overview and fact sheet, just, you know, giving some sort of broad context to the neighborhood, a brief description of the neighborhood's history, a vision statement, and then three primary topics of policy focus. One is land use, one is natural environment, and then another is transportation. And then the fourth topical section can be a special topic of interest to the neighborhood. Maybe it's historic resources, maybe it's urban design, maybe it's human services, maybe it's something else. But we really just wanted to get the plan as concise as possible. And then narrative and text would be limited in every plan, with maps showing existing and future desired conditions. Those are the things that we want to do as much talking as possible in the plan. We want there to be sort of a minimum of text and more graphics to help people really understand what the vision of the plan is, and not have to read through, you know, thousands and thousands of words. Really, the second to last section of the framework is the cookbook, what we're calling the cookbook of policy questions. And again, this is the concept here was to respond to concerns that there's lots of policy overlap between our comp plan and the neighborhood plans, and that it's hard to ascertain where the starting point for neighborhood plan policy should be. And so to help address that, this section, this cookbook, pairs citywide comp plan policies with questions to help community members think about issues that their neighborhoods are facing and how to resolve them. So things like, how can you make your neighborhood more walkable? How can we better protect the environment? Where should housing go? Things like that. And they're all keyed to specific policies in the comprehensive plan. So again, so we're not, you know, ignoring comp plan policies or creating neighborhood plan policies that are inconsistent with the comp plan policies. All right. And then last but not least, just additional ideas for consideration. These are things that we heard that could be part of the framework, but we didn't actually integrate into the framework. So I'll just go through these really fast and then we can have a discussion. But one is, do all neighborhood plans need to get updated every 8 years? Might there be a means of, if there's a neighborhood without a lot of change, preparing a memo, documenting that fact and filing it away and maybe circulating it for a little bit of public review and not going through a comprehensive update for every single plan every 8 years, which is just a lot of work for both, you know, especially for neighborhood groups. Could some of the work, such as, you know, drafting sections of the plan and policies and reviewing administrative drafts of the plan, be delegated to the neighborhood groups themselves, allowing staff time to be stretched a little bit further? Under this concept, you know, staff would still be heavily involved in the plans. It would still go through the decision-making process, but neighborhood groups would play a bigger role. Third is the concept of not considering citizen-initiated amendment requests, which have in the past taken a lot of time in neighborhood planning processes. You know, individuals come forward and they propose specific changes to their properties. They might be good, they might be not so good, but they just absorb a lot of time and a lot of effort. Perhaps, you know, the vision should guide the planning process completely. Fourth is, could consultants play a greater role in drafting the plan? Five is, could we just have a standardized process for public outreach so that we're not creating a new plan for public outreach every single time for every single plan? And that's actually something that we're doing right now. And then the next one is, which is actually what we're doing for the North and South Rose Hill and Bridle Trails and Northeast 85th Street Corridor plans. Could we combine geographically proximate planning areas together and just do one plan instead of a couple of plans for neighborhoods that are right next to each other? That's something that would allow that might allow us to better address trade-offs, like moving housing from, you know, a single-family neighborhood to a commercial center, similar to what was done in the Finn Hill project. There are other benefits to looking at bigger planning areas as well. So I just want to note that this section reflects lots of good ideas generated from the HCC in the past, from the Planning Commission, from the City Council, and some of the ideas are woven into earlier sections of the framework. You know, things like providing a digest of the plan early on in the process that we can give to neighborhood groups, and explicitly identifying areas of disagreement between neighborhood individuals and the neighborhood group and others. With that, we can move on to the questions. We came up with these questions to help guide the discussion. Tonight, I'm happy to take comments whatever way you feel fit and whatever structure you feel fit. Happy to take questions as well on the framework.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want to just let's just take it, work our way around, and have everybody have a chance to comment on what Adam's presented and ask any questions. So, Brian?
No,
start with you, Brian. John, I'm going to have him clean up because John ran, you know, he's the only one here who actually did chair a neighborhood plan update. And I'd like him to, I'd like everybody to have an opportunity to talk before he covers everything.
Well, I think in this process you're going to run into issues regardless. Looking back, I wasn't, let's see, I think I was involved in this, in the whole plan update. But I know that what really got everybody's attention was when pictures started circulating, especially for the Houghton Neighborhood Center.
Yeah.
And so I know that all types of things that we do, you can't have pictures, but pictures worth a thousand words, and it really made a big impact in getting people involved. I also like having up front what the schedule that you showed before, mm-hmm. Because I think from the feedback that I heard, people who were disenchanted were ones that I don't think knew what the whole process was, and so they thought their feedback that we'd go and we'd analyze it, and they didn't know that this was actually step one of 10. And so they thought that it was a foregone conclusion. So I think it's important to let this over and over, let people know, you know, kind of like a long survey that you might fill out online. I only do them when I know where I am, how much longer it is until the end. if it's open-ended, I'm not going to finish it. And I just click off, you know, I don't finish it. And I become disengaged. And I think for long processes like this, especially private citizens who are very, very busy, whether it is the single mother that you talked about or not, just anybody that's busy, if they don't know what the length of the process is for what they're engaging in, they're going to become disengaged and upset because their expectations are different from what ours are. So it's just setting those expectations. So I think that is a really important part.
Thank you, Brian. Bill.
So I do think that this draft framework does strike the right balance. It looks very logical, and it follows closely, I think, the way we've actually been doing things. But it's laid out, and people can predict, you know, where, like Brian was just saying, where we are in the process and kind of understand what the timeline might look like. I like the idea of not having to do neighborhood plan updates if it doesn't make sense for that neighborhood at that time. But we need to make sure that the communication and the agreement is really done well so that nobody feels like they were shortchanged or left out of this decision after it happens. As far as the frequency check-ins, I think probably every 4 or 5 years would be good for check-ins, with the 8-year timing for actual updates.
Is that what you meant by, what did you mean by that?
I can clarify. I mean, that's sort of a good thought as well. That's something actually we didn't really even think of. I think this question here was focused more on, for any given neighborhood plan update, when does the Houghton, that's under the jurisdiction of the Houghton Community Council, when do you guys want to take a look at the plan? Is it enough to have the meetings that we have in the schedule, which are, I think give you maybe 2 or 3 check-ins? Do you want more check-ins throughout the process?
And the only one that's really coming, Bridal Trails is obviously coming up, but other than that, the other ones won't be up for a few years.
Right.
Yeah. So thoughts on that, Bill? Are you comfortable with what they've got as far as the check-ins?
Yeah, I think what's been proposed here is good, and if we want more, we'll let you know.
Okay. That's a good point. I mean, the idea here is for this to be sort of a living document. It's not set in stone. It's not adopted officially. So if something needs to change for an individual plan, it can certainly do that. If we need to change the framework later on to respond to neighborhood concerns, we can totally do that.
Yeah, it's a framework. It's not set in stone.
Yeah.
I thought this was great. Good work. It's a great framework. It's in-depth. It addresses my primary concerns. When I first started reading it, at the education, I was like, as much info as up front. What is the housing strategy plan? What are the GMA goals? What is construction happening down the road? And you captured all that, which I was thrilled. I just had a couple little things. Oh, the working group. Boy, that's a tough combo because I love our neighborhood associations and the people that are involved in them are so committed and educated and wonderful, but we need to bring people in who aren't part of that process, which you said. So how do we recruit residents who aren't really involved in the neighborhood associations? Because I think their voices are really important to bring to the table. I also thought that when we talk about presenting the draft to a neighborhood group, if we can use technology in any way, video conferencing, whatever we can do to just not make people have to come to a meeting, but they still can participate and be educated, I think that would be hugely important. I wrote, when in the process are we going to schedule the city council? I think one of the things that happened with ours is that we got to the heart of what city council wanted so late in the process, and we need to make sure that doesn't happen so far down the road. So they need to be in looking at these sooner rather than later. Oh, and I wrote that twice, so I feel strongly about that. And then when we were doing it, and I was new to this process, we kept going back to, this is what you want for a gateway, but that needs to go into the design guidelines. It doesn't go into the neighborhood plan. So again, more clarification around that up front. And then that leads me to the question of how are the design guidelines updated alongside the neighborhood plans? So they're kind of part of this process, but they're not really talked about in here, so maybe you want to fold of that in.
That's a good point.
Because we ended up doing those documents simultaneously, and I don't think we ever actually signed off on the design guidelines. Oh, and then on the schedule, and I know you thought about this, but I immediately went to what's happening June through August, because that's when people are going to disengage. And so are those review steps, is it going to be okay that everybody's on vacation in July when we'll have a study session, but you know what I'm saying is maybe we don't start in January, maybe we start in March to make sure that we capture people during when they're in town. And that was it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Great points. Neil.
I'm so new to this process, I don't have a ton to add to what you guys have already said, so I'm going to reserve the balance of my time for John, because I know he's going to have some thoughts.
Okay, John.
I did like something that Brian said, so I'll just pile on. And you said a pictures worth a thousand words. Like that whole idea that you gave of like knowing where we, giving participants a very clear picture at every step of the way, how far along we are in the process. I know that'd be super, and if you could do that pictorially, you know, with an image, I think it's super helpful. So I like that comment. That's it.
Cool. John.
I think, Adam, this is really, really good for planners that do code speak, for people in the industry. I mean, I really think that. For in going through the process intimately and chairing one of the neighborhood updates, a couple of things that I noticed is that there was, number one, way too much time spent on reformatting. And that's one of the things that's talked about here. How do we reformat so everything's consistent? I'll be honest with you. I don't think every neighborhood plan has to be exactly the same. I just don't. I think they can be individual for what the neighborhood wants. I think that's important because if you have some citizens that have been in a neighborhood for a long time and have been part of the previous plan, it's been 20 years since one of them is done, so they might not be, right? But they put that plan in place, and if it's important to them, they should look at it again to start the process. What did the plan say the last time we did it? And I don't think that's really talked about in here enough. What did the plan say we wanted to do? Did we achieve it? How do we want to change it? It's really that simple. And so I look at all the charts and all this good stuff, and I think about all the people that started the process, the dozens of people that were there at the beginning of the process that were exuberant to get started. And the first four or five meetings are, we're going to reformat it. It's all different. And here's a bunch of blue stickers and red stickers, and there's a blank. I mean, you know, they didn't show up a second meeting because they got lost. They just got lost. And so while this is really good stuff for people in the industry and planners that know this stuff, I'm thinking about mom and dad that care about their community or the business owner down the street that's worried about the A-frame sign and they show up and they want to plant their flag. Where do I fit in? How can I participate? Okay. And so I think Neil encapsulated it, well, on top of Kelly's comment. Every meeting should start kind of here's where we're at in the process. There's the goal line. Here's where we're at. I think that's tantamount important so the people know exactly where they're in the process. And if you miss the next meeting during June, July when we're on vacation, it's fine because we're going to go through design code stuff that you probably don't care about. Okay? So too much time on reformatting. I just don't know that that's important and just people got lost. I think about how does this fit within the comp plan is important. What happens to your neighborhood plan? Where does it go to the comp plan? And how does it fit with all the other pieces that aren't in your neighborhood plan? Shoreline Management Act for Lakeview area. Okay? That sort of thing. And if we talked about it, Don, the gentleman in the audience tonight that said he wants to get re-involved, he participated in this whole process. It's been a handful of years now. And at the conclusion of this whole process, it's like this giant battleship that nobody knows where it goes, what. It should be really simple. What do we want our neighborhood to be? What is it now? And what do we want to change? I mean, it's really that simple. And I'm just, while this is really good for planner speak, I think it needs to be boiled down for, I mean, if you look at page 12, the outline, it almost could be that simple. That's really simple for anybody to sit down and understand. And open up to page 7, and we talk about our natural environment. What did it say? Where are we at? What do we want to change? And that's really my takeaway from the whole process. So really, really good stuff for planners.
Well, may I?
Yes,
I mean,
Kelly.
This is more of a document for internal process. This isn't the document that goes to the neighborhood and says, this is how we're going to do this. So I don't disagree with you I think that's not what this serves. This serves, this is how we're going to do this, but it's not how we're communicating to the residents.
Fair point. I just know all the planners that showed up, the planning process they went, the planning processes that they went through. I think that's a fair point. How do we get from planner speak to engaging
this
the public?
This makes sure that everybody's on the same page who's driving these plans, but it's not necessarily what we're going to hand off to the neighbors.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair point. Yeah. Fair point.
Anything else, John?
That's what I had.
Thanks.
Oh, okay. And if I could, picture's worth a thousand words. I love that. I'd love to go back and look at the Central Houghton Neighborhood Plan and the Lakeview Plan and the Bridal Trails Plan and see more pictures in there of, you know, this is what we have right now and our vision for this area is this. And I'd love to see that. And cool. And there's very few pictures in there. I love that idea.
So I don't have a lot to add based on everybody else has thrown in great stuff. I do want to emphasize, I think you've done an outstanding job. I really do. I think this is a great framework. I wanted to point out that to the extent that the city priorities there's been any significant changes in city priorities since the last neighborhood plan that could impact the neighborhood plan, and specifically like affordable housing, for example, I think you really need to clearly communicate that up front, that this is going to impact the plan, or it needs to, because the city's priorities have changed, and so it's a given that it's going to have an impact on the neighborhood plan. Really be clear on that. And I'd use housing as an example, but to the extent that there's any significant changes citywide. The other thing I really want to emphasize is this working group that you're planning on convening of the neighborhood leaders. When you start out with like crafting your survey, be sure that they are part of that process. At a minimum, that they review and have an opportunity to edit or you know, have their input on the survey before it goes out, because that has been a real source of complaints in the past, where it's like the city is got a predetermined outcome and they're driving it through the way they structure the survey questions, and that it starts out on the wrong foot. It's when that happens. So make sure that working group is very involved in the survey questions and how those things are written. And those are the only things I would add. So with that, I think got a really good start on the process, and I wish you well.
Thanks. Well, I need it. And yeah, I really appreciate the comments from all of you. They're really good, and we'll integrate them into the framework and sort of keep it updated. And yeah, absolutely sensitive to the idea of the working group, both involving them in the process early on, you know, with surveys and the visioning workshop and so forth, but also, as Kelly mentioned, the really good point of making sure that we're doing direct outreach to lots of other groups as well, property owners, you know, people that aren't involved in neighborhood associations, people that usually don't get involved in the process, and we're trying to do a good job with that for these upcoming plans as well. So good point.
Yeah.
And thanks for all your comments.
Yeah, the more you can do to get creative, like I've said, free beer always works if you want to get a turnout.
It'll have to be funded through a non-city budget.
Yeah.
But,
okay. So anything else administratively that you'd care to address here?
No, just wanted to mention that the next meeting is going to be exactly a month from now, the 26th of mm-hmm. March, and it's a joint meeting with the Planning Commission. So
yep.
Similar to the last meeting, we'll be talking about the hazard area.
Right. Cool. Oh, John?
Adam, I apologize for missing the last meeting. During that meeting, and I left the piece of paper at my office that had on it the upcoming work programs, one of the items on that was trees and a report for trees. Would you mind, do you know anything where we're at on that now? And if not, maybe next session you could bring that back and update us real quick.
Yeah, sure. I can give you a quick update right now. So there's a couple of tree items in the work program. I think probably the one that you're talking about is updating the tree code. Does that sound right?
That's basically kind of where I'm going.
So yeah, I mean, as you know better than me, this is a huge issue in the city. We'll be sort of comprehensively looking at the tree section of the code and updating it based in part on the work that we're taking through the process right now related to tree protection in the Homes Point overlay area. So some of that will get trickled into the this more comprehensive update that we're looking at, but it's going to take all year. We've really just started sort of scoping it out right now. So I'm guessing in a couple of months, maybe several months, we'll be coming to you for a study session, maybe in conjunction with the Planning Commission, but we really haven't done that much work on that yet. But sort of the book is open on that, and it can go in lots of different ways, and the scope is bigger than it should be, so we'll probably want to narrow it a bit.
If you could help me, or is it broken down into public trees, right-of-way trees, and private trees? Have you done that at all yet?
It's mainly going to be focused on trees on private property, and there are a couple of objectives. One is doing a better, it's like sort of a dual objectives, right? It's doing a better job of protecting our trees in the city while making it easier for people who are developing their properties to protect their trees. The regulations are difficult right now for some people to implement, so we want to simplify them, but also make it easier to protect trees and for there to be more incentives to protect trees. So I know I'm sort of being a little bit ambiguous about how the code might get changed, but that's simply because we haven't really started work on it yet.
Okay.
Yeah. I just want to remind everybody I won't be here next meeting.
What's more important than that?
I'm on vacation.
Oh, is it June?
I guess you told us, yes.
I won't be either. I'm going to be on a business trip.
Well, I guess I have to fly back from Arizona for the meeting then, huh?
Uh-oh.
All right, you guys. Meeting adjourned.